Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me today, back from lovely, balmy Vietnam, is my cynic and co-conspirator, Jeremy Goldcorn. Welcome back, man.
Thank you. Very good evening to you, Kaiser.
Doubtless, you have made some very trenchant observations about the country in your time there?
Well, we'll see about that.
Okay, well, we're going to get to that in a bit. Also with us today is our old friend, Ed Wong, Beijing-based reporter for the New York Times. Great to see you, Ed.
Good to see you.
And you just got back from the United States, where you were on the trail.
Right, of our next great leader.
All right, and so obviously that little foreshadowing there, that's going to be one of our big topics. And finally, and not without a note of sadness, we welcome back Adrian Meng, the ABC at NBC, and my soul sister of sorts. Our parents know each other. Adrian, why, oh why, are you leaving Beijing?
I have gotten a promotion. I'm going to be moving to the other side. I'll be running our bureau in London.
Oh, wow. Okay. Very cool. I didn't know that you were running the bureau. So you're not going to be on camera anymore?
Nope. My reporting days will be suspended. We'll see what happens. We'll see if I survive this job.
You will be sorely missed in Beijing. And we're going to see you Saturday night at Temple for your big blowout.
Great.
Okay. So I also wanted to give a shout out to our new interns, Nicole C. and Hudson Lockett, who are pitching in now and saving me loads of time. Welcome aboard, guys. You can't hear them, but they just said, oh. Two main topics today. First, predictably, we're going to be doing a post-game on Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping, who recently paid a visit to the United States. We'll talk about who he is and what we know about him and how his visit played both here in the U.S., or rather there in the U.S. and here in China, how the Obama administration handled this visit and what came out of it. And if we have time, we can also quickly update about the rumors that we spoke of 2 weeks ago and all the new rumors that have bubbled up since and what kind of a political landscape Xi Jinping has returned to. Then we're going to be looking at the growing oeuvre. How do you say that word?
Oeuvre.
The growing oeuvre of a relatively new pro-Peking polemicist on the scene, the venture capitalist Eric X. Lee, who in the last 18 months has been writing op-eds in a number of pretty high-profile publications, including the Christian Science Monitor, the Huffington Post, and the New York Times. But first, let's chat a little bit about Vietnam. It's a country where I have not, alas, spent too much time, but for anyone traveling there from here or maybe here from there, it's difficult for me to imagine not making comparisons to China. I'm trying to sort of put it along the timeline of all the changes that have happened here in China. Jeremy, so you were just there, and Ed, you and your wife have spent probably quite a bit of time.
Right. Well, my wife has spent a lot of time. I've gone there on some trips. So.
Just some trips.
Right.
Adrian, you've been there many
times
as well.
I've been there a few times, yeah.
And so I'm really the only person who's not spent time. I've been there just on little work things. But with the caveat that there's really, you know, certainly no easy match. So, but gun to your head, Ed, where do you put Vietnam in terms of economic reform, in terms of development, in terms of, you know, political reform or openness to the outside world, or what have you, in terms of China's recent history?
Well, I think, historically, Vietnam often looks to China first as the bellwether, and then they let China do the experimenting, then they follow it. There's close relations between the two communist parties. Officials often visit each other. There's obviously huge diplomatic conflicts between the two countries, especially over South China Sea right now. But in terms of economic reforms, I mean, it has had the second fastest growing economy in Asia behind China. And a lot of the reforms it's adopted, which it calls Doi Moi, which is modeled after Gaigo Kaifang, are similar to China. And it encourages private entrepreneurship to a degree, but at the same time still has huge investments in its state-owned enterprises, just like China does.
Oh, when did the reforms actually get underway in Vietnam? I'm a total ignoramus about this.
I think it was around the 1980s.
Okay, in the right. 80s, in the decade of the 80s. So not too far behind China.
Yeah, not too far. I could be wrong. I mean, I haven't studied.
And have they been growing for a couple of decades at you know, 7-8%?
I don't know what the exact percentage is, but it's been growing pretty fast. There's certain things about the political system which are different than China's. Like, for example, China, like the three top titles for the leader in China are all concentrated in one person. Xi Jinping will presumably get all three titles sometime in the next year to 2 years.
General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, President, and the head of the Central Military Commission.
Right, but in Vietnam, it's actually split between three people. And, of course, the party secretary has the top position. It's not so the leaders don't feel as distant because it's a smaller country. And so, for example, a few years ago, you saw a lawyer actually try and bring a lawsuit against the prime minister, which would be unheard of in China. Like, you would never have something like that happen in China.
Absolutely.
Jeremy, just looking at the GDP, sorry, I just did a bit of a cheat and looked on Google's public data.
Why Google?
They have – sorry, there wasn't one I could find on Baidu, but they have a GDP
growth
rate.
I'm sure it's there.
So in 1995, they had a GDP growth rate of 9.54%, which seems to be the all-time high for Vietnam of the last 15 years. And then with the Asian crisis, that dropped down to under 5%. But it's now back to about 6%. So loosely tracking China. I mean, it's not 8%.
Right.
But
there are certain problems that China doesn't have yet, which is they have a huge inflation rate. Like, I think its inflation rate right now is in the double digits, and it's been that way for at least a few years. Mm-hmm. So, and also the currency is devaluating very quickly because we're trying to grapple with some of these issues.
If I may just offer some travelers' anecdotal observations, two things. One thing, we went to Ho Chi Minh City, otherwise known as Saigon, and spent a little bit of time there, and then drove out to a place called Moi Nay, which is a resort town. I think it was basically a village 5 years ago, and it's now been taken over mostly by Russian tourists who sit on the beach in their thongs despite weighing, 200 pounds or more. So the experience of Vietnam was rather limited. But driving from Saigon to Moi Nay, it felt kind of like China. You leave Saigon, there are development zones. There are huge lots full of construction equipment. There are roadworks. It feels approximately like a second-tier city, Ho Chi Minh City, when you the feel of it.
It feels like, say, a Foshan or some Pearl River Delta city. Is that
something like that? Perhaps
that's what I got. I mean, the scooters and the
lot of scooters. Apache development, some very expensive stuff, cars, building some very cheap and ghetto third world stuff. Another observation, though, when it comes to certain kinds of freedoms, I think Vietnam is actually ahead of China. The internet is much less censored than China. I'm sure it's...
Do you mean only foreign sites not being blocked? Do you have any way of actually knowing whether internally it's...
Sorry, censored? I should clarify that. I don't read Vietnamese, and I didn't spend time talking to people about that. For example, Facebook is supposed to be blocked in Vietnam, but it depends which ISP you're using. It's available in many places. And there's a kind of attitude towards the internet that's very different from here. For example, a lot of roadside cafes, even ones that aren't catering to backpackers, they're catering to Vietnamese, just have an open Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi with no password, just because they want you to sit there and drink coffee. This is rather different from China. The government obviously doesn't see censoring the internet as such a priority as the government of China does.
And so, Adrian, what about you in the trips that you've made there? What surprised you most as something that stood out as remarkably different from the China that you've known over the years?
Well, the first few times I went was in the mid-90s, and it was just on the heels of kind of this freewheeling optimism that had gripped the country that, it was opening up, relations with the U.S. were normalizing. And I had a few friends who were foreign correspondents there. And it changed dramatically within, I would say, a couple of years, the political climate and also the maybe not strictly the policies, but certainly the attitudes towards foreign investment. Because if Vietnam had been touted as this next great big place to invest, one of these, it was going to be the next newly industrialized country in Asia. And my sense even then was that the cycles were perhaps a lot more shorter and more compressed in Vietnam, meaning somebody described it like an accordion. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it would loosen up for a few years and then it would kind of tighten again. And not being that familiar with the ins and outs of the political system there, I don't know how much of that was because of particular infighting within the party or if it was because they were kind of observing what was happening around them, maybe in China. and deciding that they wanted to step back. Also, the other thing is the North and the South are extremely different. Mm-hmm. I mean, the South feels so much more like Southeast Asia or maybe Guangdong province, but the North feels far more Chinese to me. I haven't been back there in a few years, but the last few trips I've been to...
I think that's true. I was in Hanoi, 2 years ago, and that it did certainly felt a lot more like Beijing than...
Yeah. Right. I mean, you are in the seat of government.
What would you say? I mean, I'm sure that in the course of conversations, all three of you have talked about their attitudes toward their enormous neighbor to the north. The recent fracas over the South China Sea aside, how would you characterize the spread of attitudes toward China? Anyone want to take a crack, Ed?
I hear about this a lot. From my wife Tini, who's Vietnamese American, her and her family. I mean, there's definitely a lot of suspicion of China. I think any Vietnamese, there's a very long historical animus that the Vietnamese have had towards China because they see themselves as a country that won its independence and a country that always has to.
Right, the two national heroines, right, the Truong sisters.
Right, exactly. And of all the people who've tried to colonize Vietnam, the French, the Americans, the Chinese, it's the Chinese that they are most suspicious of. So because it's their neighbor, they're right to the north. And because there are enough cultural similarities between the two countries where I think they see themselves as like having to maintain that border in order not to be assimilated back into China.
And what's the presence of China look like physically on the ground there? I mean, I noticed when I was in Ho Chi Minh City a couple of years ago, an enormous ICBC China Development Bank building. I saw a lot of sort of financial presence, quite a number of sort of, you know, white goods, the Haiyar and whatnot. Did you get a sense for sort of the physical presence of China there?
Yes, I did. I think you're right. There are banks, there are big companies. I haven't been to Laos recently, my sense is that it's a lot less obvious than it is in Cambodia and Laos. Cambodia, it's certainly very, very obvious. It sort of almost feels like they're taking over. You know, Vietnam, it doesn't feel like that. One also should remember that Vietnam has a large ethnic Chinese population.
Right.
Who may not identify with the People's Republic, but, you know, do use Chinese signs on their businesses, etc.
Okay. I need to get back there soon. I think it's a very interesting thing. Is there anything that you guys would recommend that one read a good book on Vietnam today? Anyone have a good title to look at?
There's no. I haven't seen in terms of popular literature. Not since the 1990s has there been like a fairly comprehensive on the ground book written. Like in the 90s, there were two books like people who were working in Vietnam at the time, reporters like my wife would cite two books to read to sort of get a feel for Vietnam as it was changing in the 90s. And the one was called Vietnam Now by David Lam, who was a LA Times correspondent. The other was called Shadows and Wind by Robert Templer, who was an AFP correspondent there. But those are like general interest books that was capturing Vietnam in that transitional stage. It's still in transitional stage, obviously, but there hasn't been any recent literature that's been cited on it.
That's interesting. That strikes me as very odd. Nobody is really updated. I mean, so these
right,
books.
There's been lots of academic books written, but in terms of like popular interest books, right? No.
There's good literature that's been translated.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you guys think of something, let's put it up on the podcast page. It's something so I'm certainly interested in. Let's move on for the time being to our next topic, which of course is Xi Jinping, anointed successor to Hu Jintao, and his recent trip to the United States. Ed, you're the natural starting point with this, having just sort of, you know, been along with him. But actually, let's start with something very simple that we can all trip in on here. What do we know about Xi Jinping? Can anyone give us a basic biographical overview of his early life, his career? And what do we know of his personality? What do we know about his character? What can we really kind of deduce about his political inclinations? Anyone want to give that a go? Let's start with where he came from. Who was his father? Who was his father?
I mean, I can talk. His father's Xi Zhengxun, who's considered one of the sort of Communist Party heroes. I mean, depending on what era you examine his history of the party, he's either considered a hero or an outcast because he was...
Fell out of favor during the Cultural Revolution, but otherwise, right?
Right at the start of the Cultural Revolution, or even right before it actually, like, Mao purged him from the party. He was eventually rehabilitated by Deng Xiaoping. And then he helped oversee the start of Shenzhen and the special economic zones. Mm-hmm. So he's considered someone who's – he's always had a good reputation in the party. He has somewhat of a reformer of the reputation of a reformer. And he's he doesn't have – there are less ambivalent attitudes about him and the Xi family compared to, say, Bo Xilai and his father.
We'll get to him.
Right. We'll talk more about that later. But the there's a lot of good capital built up around the Xi family within the party.
Okay.
So Xi Jinping grew up in a compound here in Beijing as part of this party elite. And but then when his father fell out of favor, then he himself was sent to the countryside in Shaanxi. And I think he was sent there because that was his father's power base. So he wasn't – he would be somewhat protected while he was there.
He wasn't full-blown exile.
Right.
But he still was forced to denounce his father, and he did so, right?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay. So, I've read that somewhere. But
right. But anyways, he went to this village called Liangjiahe, which I visited at one point. And there he spent 7 years. He worked – he, like, worked with the peasants. He helped do stuff like build dams. Farmed in the fields. People said he has a strange accent when he first arrived there because I guess he spoke like a Beijinger, and right. The Shaanxi people came in pretty strong accents. And he read at night. He lived in one of these cave homes, the Yaodong.
Mm-hmm.
And then he eventually became the head of the village, the equivalent of the party secretary, the head of the work brigade in the village.
So this is still in the 1970s.
Right. Then he went to Tsinghua University. Afterwards,
the new generation of the new class,
technocrats who were going. But he got his, he eventually got a PhD at Tsinghua. But you know, it's unclear how much of that the thesis was written by him. It was how much a lot of people were sort of getting degrees at that time in his generation of up and coming party leaders. Then he went to Hebei province.
We can ask Fang Zhouzi to investigate.
Right. Oh, his first job actually after that was, his first political job was in Beijing. It was as a aide to Geng Biao, who was the essentially equivalent of the chief of staff, the military chief of staff at the time. And then he went to Hebei province and worked his way up through provincial jobs from there.
Right, and including like selling chicken feed and taking a trip to Muscatine, Iowa, is that right?
Right. This when is he was while in Hebei province, he was part of a delegation that went to Iowa in 1985 to look at pig farming techniques.
Oh, it was pig farming techniques. Yeah. Okay. No better place to go.
And was
that.
There a rumor that he had actually been to the States before that?
Yeah, it wasn't. It doesn't seem to be a rumor. So here's the thing. This is one interesting thing that took place on this trip was he kept advertising, like when I was in L.A., we were in a classroom where he was visiting students, and he said, oh, my first trip to the States was to Iowa and Muscatine, and I really learned to, like, admire and like Americans, and I went there on this trip, and it brought back all these memories of my first trip. So he's selling this trip to Iowa as his first trip, but Nicholas Platt, who's a senior diplomat, retired former president of Asia Society, former
he was also
ambassador
here,
right? And he and then at one point he was working in the Pentagon, and he helped organize Geng Biao's trip there in 1980, I believe. And he says that based on reliable sources that Xi Jinping went with Geng Biao because Xi Jinping was Geng Biao's top aide at that point, and that he went to the U.S. That was Xi Jinping's first trip to the U.S., and Jin Zhong, who runs Open Magazine in Hong Kong, who's also researched Xi's background, says the same thing.
And this would have been in 1980.
Right, okay. 1980. So I don't know. So it's kind of unclear, like, whether Xi is, like, sort of trying to build this myth of himself as having gone to the U.S. first to, like, hang out with the common folks, the farmers in Iowa, because going there as part of a PLA delegation is a decidedly different image, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Jeremy, what's your sense for how his trip was perceived here in China among people who were watching it?
It seems it's one of those things that wasn't really, you know, it wasn't like a hot subject on Weibo, really. But I think generally, as in the West, the perception has been positive. He obviously is presenting a smiling face to the world. To everybody, this is a welcome relief after a decade of Mr. Robot,
Hu Jintao, no embarrassment,
who doesn't appear to be human at all. So I think it's positive. I mean, I didn't. There was very little negative coverage anywhere in English or Chinese, whether it's websites and news organizations in China or outside of China. There wasn't a lot of negative coverage. You know, Yu Jie, the writer right. who's recently exiled himself to the United States, had a piece in English. Where was it? In Foreign Policy, I think. Saying that Xi Jinping is just another party hack and no need to get excited about him. And there were, you know, negative notes like that. But overwhelmingly, I think the press
Surprise,
coverage and the social media discussion was positive.
And Adrian, how did you feel like he played in the heartland of America? I mean, did people receive him well?
It seems like it. But, I mean, as Jeremy noted, the bar was set so low by Hu Jintao. So there's just the fact that Xi Jinping seemed human.
He had a glimmer of personality in him at all.
He definitely seemed very personable and seemed very confident. I think that was something that communicated itself, telegraphed very clearly on camera. He didn't seem stiff at all, and he seemed very savvy.
Don't you think that was whoever arranged the itinerary was very smart?
Iowa was masterful.
Yeah, I suspected it might have been on the U.S. side that suggested it, but Biden... Like Vice President Biden spoke to a bunch of reporters and he told us that it wasn't his idea to do the Iowa thing. It was C's people who suggested the Iowa thing. Yeah,
it was quite redolent, I thought, of American style campaigning.
It seemed to play in a slightly subtle, different way to both the China audience and the U.S. audience. I mean, I think both audiences would have come away with slightly different messages, but still positive.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's, I mean, an absolutely a good thing. The fact that a Chinese leader kind of knows how to talk to America in this way, there's nothing bad about that.
Just before the trip, there were a couple of things that people raised as potential stumbling points. Of course, one was China joining with Russia in vetoing a UN Security Council resolution calling essentially for the ouster of Bashar al-Assad. The other, of course, was this business that happened in Chengdu, which we talked about with Wang Lijun and Bo Xilai. Did either of these emerge as issues publicly, at least?
Syria one did. One point during a trip when there was some obvious hint of tension that showed policy differences was there was a State Department lunch that was held for Xi Jinping on his first full day of meetings in Washington. And at that lunch, Biden gave the sort of keynote speech at the lunch. And his speech was essentially a long list of complaints, policy complaints about China. And he started it off with that rather than with areas of cooperation.
Intellectual property.
Right. There was the economic stuff, intellectual property, currency valuation.
Currency valuation, right.
Technology transfer. He said that everyone has to play by the same rules of the game. And then he also mentioned Syria, and he said they were disappointed that China vetoed the resolution and saying that. And he said that the U.S., for the U.S., human rights is a cornerstone of, foreign policy. So that was a very explicit issue that was raised. And there's a lot of speculation why Biden came out so strong on this. And, you know, it's an election year in the U.S. that one of the things that people talked about is it's an election year. Yes, the Republican candidates have been coming out strong on China with very strong anti-China messages. And so there was some speculation that Obama and Biden had to.
Ed, can I interrupt? Because, your newspaper, as we all know, is the New York Times, is only read by liberal college professors and bi-coastal, effeminate, Euro-weenie hugging, panda-hugging elites. So maybe we can ask Adrian, being on TV, the medium of the broad masses. I mean, do you think there's been any change in the American public's perception of China because of this visit? And not the bicoastal elites.
I think we
need the red state perspective.
Yeah,
the red state
I
perspective.
I think it's too early to say. I don't think one visit by someone who seems a bit more human, but whose name is still not pronounceable to your average American is going to change
just the feminine
their
pronoun,
concerns I mean. About jobs, their concerns about the state of the U.S. economy, the fact that China's military might be outpacing, you know, the U.S. military. I think those concerns don't get changed overnight by one visit. I think people may be reassured that there is a face that seems recognizable, human. Maybe it's one small step towards changing it, but I don't think it would have changed dramatically.
Let's go back to the Beltway and talk about Ed was just talking about how Biden came out swinging pretty hard with a pretty strong litany of complaints. This isn't something we would have heard in the year 2009, in the early days of this administration. How has this administration, the Obama administration, changed in its tone and in the way that it treats with China? And is there any evidence of that here in the Xi Jinping visit?
Well, there was a lot in 2009 that was written about how I think Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said, oh, we're putting human rights on the back burner, like we want to figure out how to engage with China on fine issues of common interest. And I think the Obama administration made a concerted effort to try and work on things like climate change. That was one of the big things. Like in the lead up to Copenhagen, they really wanted to see if they and China are the two largest, you know, emitters of greenhouse gases in the world. And they wanted to see if they could find common cause there to sort of...
How's that working out for you guys?
Yeah, well, as you saw, like, it didn't work out well. Like, there was too many differences to bridge, I think, on that front, and they're still working on it. And so with that and with other policy changes, like things going in the South China Sea, which we mentioned earlier, then things became more tense.
Right. And still, in spite of the harder line that apparently was taken on this with you know, bases in Australia, I mean, the whole run-up, you know, renewed.
Right. The base is a symbolic thing. There's no – it's not a realistic military presence.
Yeah, 2,500 Marines. But Mitt Romney, whose future as America's president is far less of a sure thing than Xi's is as China's, wrote a very, very strongly worded op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in which he reiterated his promise on day one to label China a currency manipulator. And he wrote things like, I will never flinch from ensuring that our country is secure, and security in the Pacific means a world in which our economic and military power is second to none. It also means a world in which American values, the values of liberty and opportunity, continue to prevail over those of oppression and authoritarianism, which presumably are Beijing's values, oppression and authoritarianism. The sum total of my approach, he goes on, will ensure that this is an American, not a Chinese century. We have much to gain from close relations with a China that is prosperous and free, but we should not fail to recognize that a China that is a prosperous tyranny will increasingly pose problems for us, for its neighbors, and for the entire world. What's that all about? I mean, was that just, you know, to try to sort of take fire out from under Obama, or was this, I mean, is this going to be a pillar? I mean, we've talked about this before. I just cannot see him taking office and not eating crow. I mean, just simply.
I think you're right. I think it's a pretty well-trod script, isn't
right.
it?
Right. We've seen this movie. Right?
And even the Chinese seem to be au fait with that narrative.
And I mean, I think Rick Santorum is possibly the most despicable politician in America, but he did have it right when he called Mitt Romney a well-oiled weather vane.
Okay, I mean, we've talked about that enough. There's one last thing. You know, they'll probably save the announcements of the big Boeing fleet purchases until Xi's first visit as sitting president. But for now, at least the U.S. got something, or Hollywood got something, right? What did you make
you mean
of
Americans
this?
In Beijing got something?
14, yeah, we got 14
more
films
movies.
14
on IMAX.
Crap movies.
Right, 3D exactly. IMAX.
Exactly.
More Smurfs.
So, yeah, enhanced formats, IMAX, because I always go see those. And 3D films, but I guess the 2D versions of them as well.
Right.
So effectively, the quota gets bumped up by you know, quite a bit, right? From 20 to now at 34 or whatever. What did you make of that?
We'll see what happens next year.
How good the movies
come
are.
In because, you know, even the current quota of 20, you know, what can happen is, you know, Transformers becomes the biggest hit at the same time as X nationalist movie is supposed to be the big hit. And then Transformers is taken off the screens. So I think this kind of thing, when in China, you know, it's a Chinese style contract, which means it's the beginning of the negotiation.
Oh, one more thing on the Xi Jinping business. Just, I guess it was yesterday, the Tsinghua sociologist, or she's a sociology student, Leila Hung Fincher? Yeah, that's her married name. She's an American woman, doctoral student in Tsinghua, wrote an article that Ed, when we saw it on a certain
listserv
that can't be named.
will remain unnamed.
It was a piece which noted with interest a talk that she had given, Xi Jinping had given, so not she, the... God, it's going to be a field day. I mean, the whole who's on first thing is.
Well, we saw the foreign policy article and like the best pun headlines you can make with his name.
Right, she's got to have it.
Right.
Anyway, I'll send you guys a really good who's on first routine that was, you know, who, when, and she. Anyway, so he gave this talk at the party.
She gave this talk.
He gave this talk. It and she, meaning Leta, focused on the fact that in Xi's speech, Xi Jinping's speech, he made direct reference to the period of the early 1960s when certain brave party officials reported back truthfully on conditions that they'd found. I mean, we're talking, and although it's never explicitly said so, we're talking about the disastrous aftermath of the Great Leap Forward. And Leta suggests that he's drawing a parallel between that time, the GLF, and the years that followed, with the present. Is that your sense of what he was actually doing with that speech?
I haven't seen the original text. So
I did. I read it.
Right, you did. So yeah. I'm reluctant to draw conclusions, but from looking at the translated excerpts that she pulled out, it seems like he's Xi has said certain things before. Like he said, oh, we don't want any more empty slogans. Like there to be more substance behind party policies and things like that. So I think he's just trying to get people to go out and just dig deeper and find out more about conditions. I don't think he's necessarily drawing a direct line with.
Right. I mean, he's not talking about, you know, about wholesale fraud of statistics and massive overcapacity or anything like that. He's not talking about Great Leap Forwards. I mean, the Gordon Changs and maybe even the Michael Pettises of the world are going to assume that this is what is being said,
right,
here. But I think that what he's really getting at here is more, you know, social injustice, you know, staving off another Wuhan, staving off other things like this.
Right. Although, I mean, I think anyone in his position, any of the top leaders, are looking very carefully at the economic model right now. And they have to be because there's been enough questions raised. Today there was a report in the Wall Street Journal that said the World Bank and a Chinese think tank that reports to the top leaders just put out a report saying China really has to steer away from its model of relying on SOEs as the main driver of the economy and encourage private entrepreneurship. So
you're here.
I mean, you work for one of these companies. So
That's right. So
I think that any leader is going to be telling – If they're trying to guide China in the proper direction, they're going to be telling their underlings to really examine the conditions under which the current economy is being propped up and see what changes have to be made.
Okay. Let's leave that topic for now. I mean, we can talk forever, and we'll have plenty, 10 years to talk about Xi Jinping.
We didn't even begin to discuss his wife.
No, we didn't.
Famous folks.
We'll do an entire round.
Can you sing one of her songs?
No, I
said I can't sing that high. I'm sorry. Anyway, let's move on and talk about the growing body of writings by Eric X. Lee. Just a little bit of bio on this guy. He's founder and managing partner at Shanghai-based Chengwei Venture Capital. Full disclosure, I have options in a company in which he invested, Youku, and I've actually communicated with him, you know, in my former capacity as somebody who worked for Youku. But we'd never met. I spoke to him on the phone briefly. He'd actually I offered him to sort of, you know, comment on sorts of questions that I want to raise now. And he said he'd rather sort of let his work speak for itself for the time being, although he's open to talking to us at another time. he is a PhD candidate now at Fudan University. He's done some charitable work. He's also on a couple of think tanks and has been writing in quite a number of pretty high-profile publications, including most recently in the New York Times. What he argues, is this something different in your minds from – let's start with you, Jeremy – from that old line of argument that we're accustomed to hearing, the old Asian values debate, the neo-authoritarian argument of the 80s, where you have the one-party state in eventually enjoying the fruit of stability and growing wealthy enough that it invariably morphs into a multi-party democracy a la South Korea, Taiwan? Or is this a different argument?
Well, it reminds me a little bit more of this sort of Asian values argument that used to be fairly popular, that there's a set of values that work in East Asia that are superior ways of managing a country. But it's not quite the same as that. There are some interesting features to some of his arguments. I think his most recent piece that is basically the reason why we're talking about him today appeared in the New York Times, which was in the Times, the headline was, I think, Why China's Political System is Superior, right?
That's right.
And one of the points he makes in that is that he thinks that Westerners, and I think he's really talking about Americans.
He is. He's pretty explicitly talking about Americans.
Have this faith in democracy that's almost akin to a religious faith. And this particular point, for example, I am very sympathetic to, because I do think there is a kind of a political discourse in America where you cannot question democracy.
Yeah, it's a dogmatic tenet.
It's dogmatic. Right. Democracy is an absolute good, and electoral democracy is the highest faith to which we must all bow down in front of which. And I think he's very much correct in identifying this. And it is a problem, I think, when it comes to particularly the American media looking at China, or maybe more to the point, Iraq. I think, you know, one of the reasons why so many smart people were fooled into supporting the Iraq war was that they believed that somehow this groovy democracy powder would be sprinkled over the entire Middle East after the invasion of Iraq.
My colleague Tom Friedman was one of the biggest proponents of that theory, that the road to the rest of the Arab world was through Iraq.
Through Baghdad. Right.
And I mean, he's had to, even the great Tom Friedman has had to eat humble pie, really, on that. And I think as much as I sympathize with Eric Exley, many of his points look at this and say, you know, it doesn't actually have to be this way. It's not it's not everywhere in the world where we feel that, you know, democracy is the highest goal. So that is different from the Asian values and different from some arguments.
Right. It's more assertively statist. It's more, yeah. I mean, it's an assertive, more virulent strain of that. What he's saying is that it's not just better suited to China or to East Asia, that a strong state is. Adrian, chime
in
here.
Being the TV person in the room, I'm going to focus on the style, not the substance.
Are you a TV person or blogger?
Yeah, yeah.
By night.
Blogging is all substance, no style.
I think what I found interesting about his writing is actually the style, the sort of the manner in which he uses the English language. It's almost like sophistry. He does, as Jeremy said, he makes these points that individually you might not find anything wrong with them, but taken as a whole, they could be quite problematic depending on your politics. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you could even mention his name in the same breath as Tom Friedman, he is being published in a venue, in a forum, which reaches a very different kind of audience than, say, your Global Times op-ed pieces or your China Daily English version op-ed pieces. I mean, this is someone who uses language in such a way that maybe your elite establishment could relate to.
He's pretty skillful, you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah, he is.
But I don't think his message is that.
I think you're
different.
Giving too much credit to the to this publication, which I write for almost every day. Like, I mean, I feel like that there's it's not this vaunted publication. There's a wide, especially now it's a very big tent. There's a wide range of voices. There's a wide range of linguistic abilities that are represented in it also.
I mean, so okay, what's the nub of what he's saying, though? He talks about this American democratic system, which has been, you know, Californicated or Californizated or whatever, endless referendums, he says, paralysis, insolvency. But the nub of the difference that he sees is, you know, here, Washington, here, a metonym, I guess, for American political culture, as I see it, sees political rights as God-given and absolute. Beijing, meaning the Chinese political culture here, I think, maybe, sees them as conditional, as he says, privileges to be negotiated based on the needs and conditions of the nation. I actually haven't encountered, maybe I haven't seen it formulated in quite this way, but this is, I mean, it rings very familiar to me, but I'm hard put to cite chapter and verse where I've seen this argument. Maybe some of you guys can help me out here. Is this just a variation on that kind of ethical absolutism of the Americans versus the kind of Chinese pragmatism and the kind of ethical cultural relativism that kind of comes with that territory? Or is this more subtle or more brutal, or should I just forget everything?
Well, let me go to the first point you mentioned, which you talked about, where he talks about the California referendum.
Yeah, that's a straw man, okay. But
right, but I mean, I didn't find his op-ed that provocative because I'd seen the arguments made in lots of other places before. For example, Fareed Zakaria in his book, The Future of Freedom, the entire book is dedicated to the point that America's democracy is paralyzed right now because of various things like interest groups, lobbying, the effect that there's too much money in the system, and that there's no way for a third party to really emerge, and there's no alternative voices other than the two parties that want to maintain the status quo. That's exactly the argument.
Well, red-blooded Americans make that argument every day, right?
Right, and that's exactly – so the Tea Party people are making it, the Occupy Wall Street people are making it, and Eric Lee is making it. It's like a very common, almost mainstream argument to be made. And then he goes on to say that – the way I interpreted it is somewhat different than the way that you're saying, because I feel like the ultimate argument he's making is that – democracy is the end. I mean, he states it explicitly, I think I'm paraphrasing him, but he says democracy is the end, whereas for China, that's not, like, the political system is not
mere
the
means
end.
To an end. Right.
Right.
Does say exactly that. Right.
Right. But I think that anyone who's an observer of China today, it would be hard-pressed, and even if you talk to ordinary Chinese, it would be hard-pressed to say that part of, both in the U.S. and in China, there's a strong drive by the people who are in power to maintain the political system, and that's the end. Like, the Communist Party's goal is to maintain its hold on power, and the goal of Democrats and Republicans in some ways is to maintain this two-party system that they have and to make sure that they can, you know, each vie for offices, but they would feel very threatened if there were a third party, viable third party that emerged.
That's an interesting interpretation of it.
I would say that for me,
that's my interpretation, rebutting his argument.
Right.
So,
right.
What stands out for me as an objection to some of his writings is basically that he is a paid up member of the 1% in China. He's a wealthy capitalist, a venture capitalist with very close ties to the ruling elite, and many of his pieces talk about, I mean, you know, one of them was titled "China's Critics Don't Represent the Voice of the Chinese People."
That appeared in
the Christian Science Monitor. And it was after the Wenzhou train crash, where he was saying that some of the more extreme voices on Weibo, for example, don't really represent mainstream Chinese opinion. Now, he has a point. A lot of the bitching and moaning on Weibo is a bunch of, you know, he characterizes them basically as frustrated Chinese intellectuals. And you know, again, like with many of the things he writes, I think he's absolutely right there. That certainly is a big component of the bitching and moaning on Weibo. On the other hand, he doesn't really have much in common with ordinary Chinese people. I'm pretty sure, as someone who spends most weekends tramping around the hills in the countryside, I spend more time with Chinese peasants than he does. And I'm pretty sure that as somebody, you know, who's a small businessman who employs ordinary Chinese people and deals with them on a day-to-day basis, I spend more time on a day-to-day basis speaking to the common man, Lao Bai Xing, than he does. And I don't think they're all that comfortable with having their views represented by people who make millions of dollars every year and who consort with the elite of the government. And this is something that I think he hasn't really answered in his writings. Okay, so democracy is a terrible system. Look how screwed up America is. But what actually is the system here in China? And how does anybody have any kind of assurance that the party will in fact respond to the needs of ordinary people?
Right, he's calling for this sort of, it's the bad emperor problem always. It's the downfall of his type of an argument.
And why do so many of his friends have green cards or Hong Kong residency permits or have their children go to school in Australia and America if everything is so groovy here?
So does he represent, though, let's finish with this, any
yeah,
kind of
ask.
Meaningful segment of Chinese society?
Yes,
do you think he represents
absolutely.
The 1%?
He represents the 1% completely. And the 1%, like in America, their views are
co-opted.
There are many people who are in the 99% who believe the same thing. So I think to dismiss Eric Exley.
Oh, I mean,
is,
so what you're saying is that 1%'s views are actually shared, in fact, by a lot of them. I mean,
yes.
All those Republicans who vote against their own economic self-interest to support the 1%.
I think China is very similar.
Full of the same
sorts.
So
I think Eric Exley definitely represents the views of the 1% in China, and he represents the views of a lot of ordinary people. How many ordinary people is something none of us know, including Eric, because of censorship and, censorship.
Well, I'd like to get him on the show, but Adrian, you had some thoughts on his representativeness.
Well, no, I had the same question about whether or not he then therefore represented the view of the 1%. I think going back a little bit earlier to what you were saying when you were trying to kind of pin down what his arguments are, the lack of defining what the system here is, at least in that New York Times opinion piece, I think what the other thing that's interesting about some of his writing is he, and maybe this goes back to your point about the Asian values, he's not necessarily one of these people who's saying this system works because China is unique. He's actually saying we have a unique system, which is a subtle difference, but it's no longer that old standby that you hear a lot of Chinese people say, well, China's different. We have all these people. We have these unique problems, these unique challenges.
He's saying that irrespective of culture, an authoritarian technocratic system is essentially ultimately more flexible
workable
than a dogmatic democracy.
Yes.
Right? That's a very something that would not go over well with many Americans. I'm absolutely not. Anyway, I want to wrap up here and get to recommendations. I hope that you've all done your homework. Let's start over with Jeremy this time. What do you got for us this week?
I have two things. The first is I'm just going to plug the place I went to in Vietnam. If you live in Beijing or Shanghai and you just need to go and sit on a beach with nice waves surrounded by massive Russian people in thongs.
That part I can do.
Get
that.
Yourself to Moi Nay. And Air China has a red eye from Beijing, which is ridiculously cheap. It's very easy to organize, and Vietnam is a nice place to go. And you can, if you Google Moi Nay, there's a guy, Moi Nay Beach, I think, .net, has a lot of information about the area. It's interesting because it's one of the driest parts of Vietnam, and there's a mini desert right there. You think of Vietnam as jungle, but there are actually sand dunes and things behind the beach. So you can do some other things aside from sitting on the beach.
Adrian, what you got for us this week?
I thought you had two tips.
She's buying time.
Yeah. Professionals, they get you every time. I just want to plug my little side project, greatwallfresh.com. My friend, Mr. Chen, the farmer running hikes at a small peasant farm hotel an hour and a half out of Beijing. There is a strong possibility that a company owned by the Shaolin Temple will take over the whole valley and kick everybody out. And this might be the last year that you can visit the Chenjiapu Valley without having to pay 50 kwai to the Shaolin monks for the privilege. So rather give the 50 kwai to Mr. Chen. GreatWallFresh.com.
What is it? I mean, like organic farm produce?
Yeah, well, they have a little farm where they farm organically because
free-range
they just
chicken.
Do. They have a few free-range chickens, so
do
good
the free-range
eggs.
Chickens eat organic food?
Most of the organic food. I mean, it's I don't know if it would pass the Oregon organic food certification, but they basically don't use any crap, and the food is good.
Okay, hot seat, Adrian, plug.
Well, I just read this book, and I talked a little bit about it with Ed earlier. It's called The Operators by Michael Hastings, the Rolling Stone reporter who had written the profile of General Stanley McChrystal got him fired.
Fired. This is like why I never let my guy get profiled. Okay, go on.
Well, it was actually a good read. It was, first of all, interesting to read a book about the war in Afghanistan because there haven't actually been that many books, I think, written about it in the same way that the war in Iraq has been covered thoroughly. So it was interesting to read for that. And, of course, his profile of McChrystal is a bit more fleshed out in the book, although it's not strictly about McChrystal. It's also about, I guess, the U.S. Military, the U.S. government, U.S. role in Afghanistan and the whole debacle.
Great. We'll definitely check that one out. Ed, what do you have for us?
Well, over while I was in the U.S., I picked up in an academic book that had been published a while ago by – it's called China Marches West by Peter Perdue, an historian at Yale. And it's a it's sort of a very detailed look. It's a large tome, and it's a very detailed look at the Qing Dynasty conquest of what we now call Western China, but you know, Xinjiang, what's commonly known as Xinjiang and Tibet. And it's just looking at the motivations behind that, the way in which the military, the various militaries carried out their campaign. And I think I've only started reading it, but you know, I have a personal interest in that region of the world. And I just think that it reminds us that, you know, the China that we have today was very much a Qing Dynasty creation, and that today's communist rulers are trying very, very hard to keep it, to hold the empire together. I mean, China is an empire, and I think that anyone who denies that China is an imperial power is has a lot of illusions, and that we have but not an imperial power in terms of it wanting to, say, conquer Vietnam right now, for example. But it's trying very hard to hold an empire together, just as the Qing rulers were trying very hard to do that. And so I think that that's the lens through which – that's why these are considered China's core interests. It's because these are parts of the territory
legacy
that
empire,
it doesn't want to let go.
Peter Perdue.
Right, Peter Perdue.
Okay, Peter Perdue. We'll definitely check that one out. And while we're on the topic of that, I mean, if you are interested in the Qing Empire in the West, James Millward – a friend of mine, a former professor of mine who's now at Georgetown, he turned his PhD dissertation into a book called Beyond the Pass. I think it's after the colon, something like Commerce and Ethnicity in Qing Central Asia. Very related topic if you're interested. I'm going to go really local on my first recommendation here and recommend, Adrian, you're leaving. You're not going to get to see these guys, but these four expatriate lads who have a terrific Beatles cover band called the Beijing Beatles. I have not had so much fun at a rock and roll show in ages. I mean, they play constantly. I mean, in the 18 months they've been together or so, they've played like 75 shows. So they're constantly playing. They have an enormous repertoire of Beatles songs, and they're incredibly entertaining, costumes, the whole deal. So I know a lot of our listeners aren't in Beijing, but most of them come through. Odds are you'll be able to see them when you're here. So do check them out. My other more directly China-related and of interest, the works of a young ethnographer, sociologist, ethnographer named Tricia Wong. I don't know if you guys have come across her stuff. She's here, I believe, on a Fulbright.
Yeah, I'd second that.
Yeah.
You're recommending her blog.
Her blog and the publications that are out there. Just look for her. You can just Google for her, Tricia Wong. She's just put out a piece about her life as a peddler selling dumplings with a family in a city that goes unnamed, but, you know, getting up at 4 a.m. with them, being chased around by Chengguan, the whole deal. I mean, she blends right in.
Is she an anthropology student?
She's an ethnographer. And we're going to try to get her on the show. She's actually based out of Wuhan. And anyway, thanks so much, Ed. Thank you for coming.
Thanks.
Jeremy, great to see you again. And let us all bid a fond, fond farewell to Adrian, who is going to be leaving us for foggy London, from old Chokey to old
Smokey. How much do dumplings cost in London? You see your guys recently.
Oh, I was there for Chinese New Year's Day, and a small steamer 8 small, very forlorn-looking dumplings cost us £8.
Oh, me. Oh, my God. I just now, I bought, like, 5 tea of Qingfeng Baozi, and it was, like, 17 kuai, okay? So,
yes, oh, you poor Chinese thing. Food.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, you'll be sorely
but
missed.
But, Adrian, you have to, I mean, like, New York Chinatown is not where you go if you want, like, proper Chinese food, right? You go to Flushing. There must be a Flushing.
There's got to be a Flushing.
No,
right.
No, and I'm not even a fan of Flushing. I grew up in New York.
It's great South Asian food.
My sister lives there. I'm sure she can set you up. Okay, anyway, we'll see you guys next week on Seneca Podcast. Take care.